You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 21st of February 2018 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show. A horrific few days, even by the standards of Syria's civil war, prompts fresh condemnation from around the world. But will it prompt any meaningful response? My guests Florence Biedermann and Carlo Bonura will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including President Emmanuel Macron's plans for reforming France's immigration laws, the efforts of Bangladesh and Myanmar to maintain relations despite the Rohingya refugee crisis, and what should Finland do with an immense Bitcoin stash it can't really spend? That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. And welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Florence Biedermann, Agence France-Presse London Bureau Chief, and Carlo Bonura, Senior Teaching Fellow in Southeast Asian Politics at SOAS. Welcome both. Now, the standards of hideousness established over the 7 years of Syria's civil war are such that when the conflict does still command international headlines, it is a certain signifier that something especially dreadful is occurring. Such appears to be the case in eastern Ghouta, the long-besieged rebel enclave adjoining Damascus, which has come under renewed bombardment by Syrian government forces in the last few days. At least 300 people have been reported killed this week. Florence, it's all we can tell of what's going on in eastern Ghouta is from the footage being broadcast out of there by people in eastern Ghouta. It is, as is the case and has been the case throughout Syria, almost impossible to report from it independently. But from what we can glean from that, do we form the impression that Assad has the idea now that he can do pretty much as he pleases?
Yes, I mean, this has been the case in other occasion in this conflict when he used gas, or there was the use of gas, and which were probably used by his troops. So, I mean, in this there is nothing new, maybe, but what is new now is that it seems to be the last step, like the last stronghold of rebels, and he is determined, and nobody will stop him to make an end of it. And as you said, yes, we have an idea of what's happening because there is all these courageous Syrian civilians who are managing like to transmit the pictures of what's going on, and it's a massacre and it's a humanitarian disaster.
Carlo, is that your sense of it, that for Bashar al-Assad at least perceives that the end game is looming and this may be his last chance wreak this kind of vengeance upon his enemies?
Yeah, I think so. And I think that there are a number of other elements which are taking place at the same time, which is Turkey's involvement in the conflict now, the collapse of the Islamic State, and of course, the fact that the United States finds itself in a fairly limited position in terms of what it can do. This shooting down of the Israeli fighter jet, I think, was a clear sign that even if the United States wanted to involve other allies to put pressure on the Assad regime at this stage, that it's not, these are going to be limited efforts. The interesting thing about the enclave here is that in terms of the rebels who are still there, it is a very mixed group of militant groups at this stage. Some of them are Free Syrian Army militants. Some of them are Islamist militants, some affiliated with Al-Qaeda, some that are not Islamic State affiliated but have the same ambitions. And so although in terms of humanitarian, at a humanitarian level, this is definitely a crisis that has to be watched. And unfortunately, there may not be anything that anybody can do. Geopolitically, it is... this is a very complex conflict, and there is no, just because people are fighting Assad does not necessarily mean that geopolitically that they fall on one side or another. So if the United States were to do something but if it were to do something to put pressure on Assad to kind of save the enclave, in effect, what it could be doing in some cases is protecting militant groups that it would find itself at odds with later on.
Well, you get the sense from the footage that the bombs landing on Eastern Ghouta are not making much of a distinction between the various factions that are controlling the enclave. Florence, we have seen a certain amount of, at this point, fairly formulaic, copy-pasted condemnation from various Western leaders in particular. Is that all that Assad can expect by way of response from anybody else?
Yeah, I think that what Carlos says is true. I mean, what kind of involvement will the Occident will have in this war now? I mean, there is Russia supporting Assad and supporting him till the bitter end. He committed troops on the ground, which the Occidental won't do. And they are also careful because their aim was to eradicate jihadis in the area. So, in a sense, Assad is helping them to do that. As Carlos said, there is mixed fighters. So they are just waiting for the end game and probably trying to play a role on kind of a transition that has been already decided and agreed upon by the Security Council of the United Nations already 2 years ago. So they may think of trying to play a role after this war. But right now, I mean, they are just spectators and they don't want to get more involved. And public opinions wouldn't accept it anyway. So,
well, just to follow that up, President Emmanuel Macron of France, who we will come to from a domestic perspective shortly, was talking fairly recently about chemical weapons as a red line in Syria, which is, of course, talk we have heard before from Western presidents. But would there be... Well, I'll start that question again. Even if he wanted to do something and felt like he did have any popular support among the French people for doing something, is there anything that could be done?
He could do what Trump has done once, which is like to bomb certain areas and then to have the planes coming back. And that's it, kind of a symbolic act. This was done once in this conflict. But what would be the result? I mean, I don't think it would be really effective and it would stop Syrian forces. It didn't so far, so why would it now?
Just a final thought on this one, Carlo, and it's obviously somewhat idle to talk about trying to see any upside of what is occurring in Eastern Ghouta, but going back to what we were talking about, is it your sense that some kind of end to the Syrian conflict is in sight?
I think so. I think this is part of the Assad regime's endgame, as was already said. In terms of the U.S. doing something or Western nations doing something, European nations doing something, I think that this is... What amazes me is that the United States has already stated that its troops, and by this I'm sure they mean special forces troops, will remain in Syria indefinitely. And yet their capacity to do anything is highly limited, aside from potentially support those forces still against the Islamic State. And so I think that not only is the end to this conflict potentially closer than what it was 2 years ago, but also I think Syria as an entity in the region is now part of this disfigured geopolitical map that the United States has intentionally rearranged through the conflict in Iraq, now Syria, and also in Afghanistan.
Well, let's take a look now at France, whose recent political convulsions have, like those in many Western countries, been driven largely by the conviction of many of its citizens that too many foreign persons live among them. President Emmanuel Macron has signalled his intention to respond to this with a tightening of immigration and asylum laws. Meanwhile, Marion Maréchal Le Pen, niece of Front National leader Marine, is in the US to speak at CPAC, an annual gathering of the kind of white people who enjoy pretending that the world is stacked against them. Florence, first of all, one of the things that Macron is reacting to are polls about the impact of immigration on France. A recent one has suggested that 63% of French people think there are too many immigrants in France, and I suspect you'd probably get similar numbers in a lot of Western European countries. In the UK, for example, I'm imagining it would be about 52-48 for some reason. But why do French people... Or why do 63% of French people think there are too many immigrants?
Well, they were the spectator of this big wave of immigration a few years ago, which was one of the reasons of Brexit, I think, because you mentioned this 48, 52. There is also...
Glad somebody spotted that.
Oh, I'm a journalist. There is also the Calais question, you know. I mean, there was this Calais jungle that were in the headlines for months and months. And this is really something that is in the mind of the people. And yes, there was this vote for Marine Le Pen during the presidential election, where she got this record voting of more than 30% of the vote. So there is, as in lots of European country, this uncertainty, this fear of migration, etc. So, but what should be done also, should be said also, is that some people think Macron's law, even in his party, is too harsh. But on the right, they think it's not rash enough. So, you know, in the end, he's taking some measures, but they are not satisfying neither the left nor the right. So it's kind of in the middle act, which will maybe please some part of the population, and I'm not sure it's the only reason why he's doing it. Yes, definitely he's doing it because he wants to show himself as acting, but what will be the results is not something that will really prevent the people from coming. It's accelerating, for example, the process to acknowledge asylum seeker as real refugees. It's that kind of reform, but it's not like let's close the border and deal with it. It's not that radical either.
Carlo, do you get the sense that President Macron is acting here out of, you know, sincere conviction or a genuine concern that the immigration laws do require tightening, or is he thinking politically and trying to cut the support from under the Front National and similar parties?
I think there's a political calculation here, but I also think that if we look comparatively, there's no coincidence that both Trump and Macron went for immigration somewhat into their not at the immediate start of their presidencies, but their time in office, but fairly close to it. And I think that there's a more general comment to be made here, which is that immigration has become a kind of generic political panic that North Atlantic democracies are now universally experiencing. And there are two points about this. The first is that this is not new. If you think about back to the 1980s in the United States, there were massive debates over immigration. And we could find examples of that, I think, in Europe as well. And the second point is that I don't think, because I do think this is a kind of panic, I don't think that it's right to simply link this to the far right. If you think back to the general election here in the UK in 2010, all three of the major parties came out against the level of immigration of European Union nationals in the United Kingdom. And that is a general stand against immigration. It is xenophobic, and it motivates politics in ways that other issues do not.
I do want to move on, Florence, to the subject of Marion Maréchal Le Pen and her planned speech at CPAC, a gathering which will also be attended, I believe I'm right in saying, by both U.S. President Donald Trump and U.S. Vice President Mike Pence and others of their general ilk. Is she a big deal in France?
She is. I mean, everybody's very excited because it's kind of a family story and drama also. Like, she is the niece of Marine Le Pen, who is the daughter of Jean-Marie Le Pen. And so the father is stabbing Marine in the back. And Marion now is again putting herself as a possible candidate to be heading the party, because she had decided to stop politics. She's suspending her participation in political life just after the defeat in the presidential election, and now she's back. I mean, she wrote a column in a newspaper explaining she wanted to create an academy of political science to attract right-wing brains and to create kind of a think tank. So she definitely is back, but not in France. That's what's funny with the story. But you will see all commentators, all media are really very excited by her coming back and being a possible rival to her aunt.
So basically, and it is very hard to tell with the Le Pen family. You do get the impression that Christmas round at their place must be an absolute riot. She and Auntie Marine don't get on terribly well?
No, she doesn't. She's much more right. She's even more right than her aunt. Like, she's pretty religious-minded. She was against gay marriage, which Marine was not against. And she was kind of close to her grandfather. So she was kind of an ally of the grandfather against the daughter and aunt, the daughter that tried to make the Front National more respectable and less extreme right, which didn't please, of course, her father. So that was kind of an alliance between the father and the niece.
Carlo, what does it tell us about the corner into which American conservatism has now painted itself that, that people of this ilk are being invited to speak at their big CPAC wingding?
This is pretty interesting. On the one hand, I think there is a fairly there are these elaborate networks, political networks between political elites in the U.S. and political elites in Europe, and they extend. It's not just the not just conservative groups, but also we can think about the way in which both the Democrats and the Republicans both received political activists and strategists from Europe, and also they sent them back to Europe in terms of these major presidential elections. Steve Bannon is a fan of this particular Le Pen.
You surprise me.
but at the same time, I think we have to keep in mind that this is not going to be a controversial news item in the United States the way it may play out, or at least to have the kind of level of popularity that it might have here. And we only need to look at Trump's intervention into Muslim politics in the UK a couple of weeks ago when he tweeted retweeted things that I think the English Defense League had posted.
Britain First
posted. That was a huge story here, and yet made no news in the United States. And the problem is, of course, and this also will not be shocking, is that Americans are incredibly insular. And their knowledge of politics in Europe is incredibly limited. And I would not be surprised if some of those, I mean, I'm just being slightly facetious here, but I wouldn't be surprised if some of those people in the room had never heard of the surname Le Pen, which is shocking and yet probably true.
Just a final thought on this one, Florence. Does President Macron have a case, or would he be able to make a case, that one of the reasons that there is such anti-immigration sentiment in France is that immigration has been badly managed, that it has been too lax, that it has not been controlled sufficiently?
Well, this is not an argument he's using. I mean, now, because some of his ministers, and by the way, the interior minister is a socialist, which means he was close to the previous government. So, yes, that would be something that the right says. It has been badly managed. There are too many foreigners. That wouldn't be. Macron is more moderate than this.
Okay, well, we are going to take a short break. Before we do that, though, I do want to bring in a voice from elsewhere. You were talking, Carlo, about the general panic about immigration that is besetting many Western democracies. And I think at that point we should note that we are sitting here in a British studio, and I don't think there's a British person at this table. But my own country of Australia is far from immune from this, and far from immune from people complaining about it. The editor of one of our newspapers, the Sunday Mail, Peter Gleeson, was on the news this week complaining that the average Australian, whoever that is sitting back and looking at some of these people, as he put it, and going, well, you don't speak English at home, you're failing to integrate properly. He received many robust responses to that, not the least of which was from a Victorian state MP called Martin Pakula, to whom I will cede the floor. He replied, my mum arrived here as a six-year-old, no English, ended up being a school teacher for decades. Dad was born here but spoke no English at home, became a lawyer. I'm the Attorney General of Victoria and you, mate, can get stuffed. Australia enough for you. We'll take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, along with Florence Biedermann and Carlo Bonura. More shortly.
Canada's welcoming attitude is luring entrepreneurs and investors. Monocle Films travels to Montreal to bear witness to the revival of Quebec's largest city and takes note of its success. As government initiatives help drive the change, we hear from Canada's innovation minister about how the country is capitalizing on restrictive US visa policies.
This is a great opportunity for Canada to differentiate itself, to really focus on promoting diversity and using diversity as a means to create more opportunities. And one key area that's really demonstrated that in a meaningful way is immigration. And we think this does really well compared to other jurisdictions in terms of branding Canada, but also really providing the fuel for the innovative economy, which is creative, thoughtful people who want to take risk.
Why startups thrive in Canada. Playing now in the film section at monocle.com.
Yeah, You're back with Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Florence Biedermann and Carlo Bonura. Now, if one was to guess which of Bangladesh and Myanmar was more likely to raise a neighbourly grievance, one might guess Bangladesh, because it is Bangladesh that has found itself hosting a refugee crisis since Myanmar began its pogrom against its Muslim minority, the Rohingyas. However, this week it has been Myanmar which has upbraided Bangladesh, asking for a cessation of the aid being delivered to refugees stranded in the so-called Zero Line. This is the unclaimed strip of land that divides the two countries. Carlo, Myanmar is accusing aid agencies who are attending to these refugees of breaking international law. Is that a high horse Myanmar really wants to get on at this point?
Well, it's a high horse in this case because it serves their interests. But yeah, you're absolutely right in terms of the violence that has that the Rohingya have experienced. Obviously, that would perfectly constitute a violation of international law in terms of the failure to protect civilians. In this case, what we find is a small strip of land. I saw it described as simply 40 football pitches wide, holding between 6,000 and 8,000 people. This land is technically within Myanmar, and hence the claim to the violation of international law. However, they also claim that these refugees are technically refugees, that they are, you know, that they have left the country, and which is the reason why Bangladesh's response to this has been to send them back to Myanmar as opposed to accept them as refugees.
Florence, as a general rule, how important is it for countries which are obviously in a state of dispute, as Bangladesh and Myanmar are, to try and maintain a degree of civil relationship?
Yeah, I think they need some external help, maybe. I think what would really help is to have an intervention of the United Nations, because on one side you have Bangladesh, a country that doesn't want to have permanently these 100,000s of refugees, which is a position you can understand. On the other, you have Myanmar, whose attitude towards Rohingya was such that you can understand they are not really in a hurry to go back. So, I mean, if there is not some kind of external neutral force that monitor it, I mean, it would be very, very difficult. Already, the process was supposed to start months ago. It did not. I mean, you don't really see a solution just between those two countries.
Yeah.
I mean, is there a risk, Carlo, in a situation like this, that a country like Myanmar could be using the willingness of a country like Bangladesh to maintain a dialogue as an excuse to avoid actually doing anything?
I think the problem right now is that the agreement has been reached, was reached 3 weeks ago or 4 weeks ago now. And the big problem is that neither the UN nor the Bangladeshi government nor even external actors like the United States believe that if the process were to begin, that these refugees would actually be protected when they arrived in Myanmar. And I mean, there's a big problem in terms of the speed of the process. Refugees have to be verified when they go back to a country. That process takes time. The government in Myanmar has only agreed to take in, I think, something like 3,000 per month, which is finish the process of repatriation by in 2 years from now. That mathematics doesn't make sense. But it's this fear among the external actors that actually prevents this process from getting rolling. And that actually is that's a real fear. But your point is a very good one. The longer that the UN or the Bangladeshi government believes that these refugees will not be protected when they go back, the longer that Myanmar, is allowed effectively to not take them back.
Florence, you mentioned the prospect of some sort of external mediator or some sort of external supervisor, like perhaps the UN. But is there a case yet, or are we potentially getting to a case where there might be an argument for, I guess, walling Myanmar off again, as it was for many, many years? Until quite recently, it was regarded as almost as insular and isolated as North Korea. Can the international community make the point that, there is a, well, could you argue that there is a benchmark of behaviours that the country needs to observe, which it isn't?
Yes, of course. But I mean, when you see Aung San Suu Kyi's attitude, for example, everybody knows there is a real issue and a real problem in the way that the country is dealing with Rohingya. So it won't be changed from one day to the other. And again, yes, it can be that happens what happened also like for other refugees like Palestine or whatever, that they will stay for years and years in these camps. I mean, there is no immediate solution. Of course, the dialogue with the Myanmar regime is very important. It has started already. It's not an easy one, but it has to go on. And in the end, there will be a solution, I guess, but it may really take years. And there is still also the possibility of camps being there for years because of the fear of the refugee to go back.
Just a final thought on this one, Carlo. Florence raises the Aung San Suu Kyi aspect again. Do we get the sense that she is in any meaningful sense in directing events in Myanmar at this point?
That's a very good question. So there are two issues here. The first is that she has to appeal to an electorate, and that those appeals are couched in terms of Burman nationalism. And this is where she is limited in terms of the type of rhetoric she can use. And I would argue even perhaps in a way that other leaders of the region are not. She has to especially be sensitive when she talks to the international press as well, which is the way you don't get this kind of schizophrenic behavior where the leaders say one thing to the international community and do something at home. Her message has been relatively consistent. But I think the problem with sanctions or isolating the regime is really that right now, the civilian authority does not control the military, does not control certain key institutions. It's not quite clear exactly what influence Aung San Suu Kyi actually has on the ground. And as a result, it'd be very difficult to figure out who to target. I think the United States State Department has tried to work through this and has applied sanctions to one particular general who was in charge of orchestrating the violence back in August. But aside from that, their options are very limited.
Okay, well, finally tonight to Finland, the government of which is trying to figure out what to do with roughly 2,000 bitcoins, which they have confiscated in seizures of the property of various ne'er-do-wells, but are not permitted by local laws to convert to euros until a court has ruled on their appropriation or store them in online virtual currency exchange. Finland's Bitcoin stash is presently worth around $23 million. No, sorry, that's $57 million. No, sorry, it's $8.56. You can see where that joke is going. Florence, this is a strange situation the Finns have. They have $23 million theoretical dollars that they can't actually bank, exchange, or do anything with. Is it weird to think of Bitcoin as a tangible asset?
That's one of one of the aspects. It's a difficult question. I mean, the central bank doesn't really acknowledge it as a currency. Still, it exists. I mean, it's used. So, I guess many people wouldn't really invest all their savings in it.
What can they do with it, though? Can they just either hope it becomes suddenly fantastically valuable again, wait till it's not actually worth anything, and then return it to the people they seized it from? That'd be quite an amusing gesture.
I think this is a fascinating problem, not simply because of the problem itself, but also because at this stage, I think legal authorities across Europe and North America are trying to grapple with how to conceptualize what cryptocurrencies are. And the United States Justice Department is going through the exact same problem. On the one hand, they want to treat cryptocurrencies as an asset, not cash. On the other hand, they want to auction it off and then bank the proceeds, you know. So this is it's very interesting how the different authorities are conceptualizing this. What I found amazing in this article, and it seems, although it's not very clear in this story, is that the trepidation about using exchanges, which is where you would typically, just to use a ridiculous expression, remonetize the asset or however you want to talk about cryptocurrencies that way, is the reason why they don't want to do that is because, in fact, these exchanges have certain problems with transparency. So if you sell the, if you try to remonetize the cryptocurrency on these exchanges, which is the easiest way to do it, you actually could literally put the coins right back in the hands of the criminals you're trying to penalize.
It is very odd. Oh, just a final thought on this, Florence. Does it need to be thought of maybe as in the same way that we think of as, you know, art, which has a value, but it's obviously not a tangible one, and it's one that can, it can go up and it can go down very dramatically. Should they be thinking of this as if they've seized a whole bunch of dodgy paintings?
Yes, like you can even give names, like, because you see a great artist whose value is diminishing. So it's kind of, but it's not a casino game. The price of a painting is also, of modern contemporary art, is also dictated by a certain sense of value, which is, you know, not based on something very solid. So it's kind of Bitcoin.
And that is it for today's edition of Midori House. Florence Biedermann and Carlo Bonura, thank you for joining us. The show was produced by Tom Hall, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and James Kitchen. Our studio manager was Christy Evans. More music next at 1900. It's The Entrepreneurs, and I'll be back with more on the day's main stories on The Daily at 2200. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London. For now, I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening.